Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, Tom Mikitas from DePaul University, and Matthew Lipman from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome to our program, coming to you from the studios of WLS and the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, we begin the program. There's only one topic this evening. Of course, if you watched or listened to this program last week, within a couple of hours after that broadcast ended, in fact, before it actually played as a television show in Chicago, it became very, very dated with the announcement from the White House that the United States military action had killed Osama bin Laden. And so that will be our topic this evening. And 1-800-723-8289. I'd like to get your assessment and your comments on how you felt when you heard the news, the reaction to it, the presidential decision not to release the photos, and just your overall feeling. A lot of people have also offered some concern about the celebrations in the street immediately following the shooting and the killing, and so we want to get your reaction to that. I mean, how have we acted as a nation? How have we acted individually when certainly it was a great sense of relief almost a decade after the 9/11 attacks. Bob Pate is with us this evening. He is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of the book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and one of the country's leading experts on air power. And we're going to begin, however, with a unique story. Today is Mother's Day.
That's right.
And before we went on the air, you were telling us a very interesting story about your mother and how you first heard the news.
Well, I was at home at 9:32. On Sunday night, I got a call from my mother, and she told me that bin Laden is dead. She had been listening to the radio, and that was the very first news. And what's interesting about that, Bruce, is that she is now 3 for 3. On 9/11 itself, at 8:02 a.m. Chicago time, it was my mother who first called me. On July 7th, 2005, the day of the London suicide bombers, at 5:45 a.m., it was my mother who first called me. And it was later, and then this week with the death of bin Laden, and she's 3 for 3. And in every one of those instances, just 20 minutes later, I got calls from the news media, and they were all shocked that I was already up on the news, ready to have a comment. And why? My mother.
So Mom got a nice present today, hopefully for that.
She did.
For being the news hound that
absolutely
she is.
Absolutely.
Matthew Lipman also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, also an expert on genocide and human rights violations and torture and things of that nature. How did you hear the news, Professor?
Well, let me, as a point of privilege, I appreciate being on the show because my mother never gets to hear me on the air. And today she is in Baltimore and she can listen on the computer. So
right.
I'm very thankful for that. I had just been reflecting with my sister on how odd President Obama's behavior had been in terms of his reaction, releasing the birth certificate, saying we didn't have time for such silliness. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner, he went out of his way to belittle the type of decision-making that Donald Trump made on his show on The Apprentice. And he seemed to be carrying the weight of the world. And when I heard this news, it suddenly became very clear what was on his mind and how well the White House had concealed this plan. None of the correspondents had any inkling for months that this was going on. So they credited the White House with, for once, being able to keep a story out of the press.
Tom Mikitas also joins us. He is a professor of history at DePaul University. How did you hear the News and your instant reaction, Tom.
Well, interestingly enough, I had just gotten back the day before from the African country of Chad, where I was helping to teach a counterterrorism course dealing with the issues in the Trans-Sahel region. So we were very focused on this. Initially, a reporter called me and said there's this rumor going around, and of course the rumor crystallized into reality, and it was pretty nonstop for the next several hours. But I was surprised, but I immediately responded that although this is very rewarding in one sense emotionally, don't expect it to change very much, and that was my initial reaction. I was wrong as to where he was. I was even then betting that, they must have got him in South Waziristan. It turned out a lot closer to the capital of Pakistan.
Now that we have a week's worth of information, Bob, what's the biggest or most significant piece of news that you've gleaned the last week?
The most significant piece of news is that this was a huge surprise to Al-Qaeda. They did not know it was coming, and it looks like we were well prepared to take advantage of that as well. So you might remember just a few days ago, there was an effort to kill one of Al-Qaeda's top leaders in Yemen, a man by the name of Al-Awlaki, and he was one of the key future lieutenants of Al-Qaeda. And undoubtedly, we are looking to pick up and take advantage of pieces of information that we're gleaning from the raid, from bin Laden's death, and even from the squawking and sort of the chatter that we're looking for. And I think that is actually the most significant piece of news in the last few days.
Professor Lippman, what's your most surprising?
I would agree. I think the files that we've gleaned from the attack in the end is going to be the most valuable result of this raid. Let me just say, though, I'm going to take a counter position for the sake of argument and say that killing bin Laden was, in fact, important because he is an iconic figure. He's inspirational. He can recruit. He can raise money. We've created a succession crisis within Al-Qaeda. I don't think his successor, al-Zawahiri, is a popular successor. We've fractured the organization, and to the extent that bin Laden has been an operational figure, which I think is something we'll discuss, we have removed him as part of the planning operation.
But again, the last couple of days, hasn't the story sort of swung to the point of view that he was an operational guy? And the photos that were released today indicated that maybe he was a little more hands-on than we thought.
And this is important because what happens when Al-Qaeda is decentralized? Is much of Al-Qaeda's strategy is a result of bin Laden's particular stamp on the organization, going for the large-scale, dramatic attack, focusing on airlines in particular. Are we going to see a different kind of strategic configuration now that he has been removed? I'm not sure that he's the operational figure that we're being told.
Tom, you were shaking your head. You don't think that.
Pretty emphatically.
Again, your area of expertise is terrorism. So.
Counterterrorism, counterinsurgency. When I researched the book, I concluded, and I would still stand by the conclusion, that he has never immersed himself terribly much in the tactical level details of any operation. The fact that he was connected to, aware of, informed of all that was going on is a bit surprising. I don't think that's the same as planning and directing it. I kind of agree with both my colleagues a little bit that, yes, he was iconic. Yes, he was the figurehead, the poster boy, the spokesman. But that's not as crucial as it was in the 1990s.
We have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, tonight we're talking about the killing of Osama bin Laden. Want to get your reaction. 1-800-723-8029. We'll take your calls in just a moment. But one of the other big issues of the past week is whether or not the president made the right decision by not showing the photos and by having the burial at sea. Mm-hmm. Your reaction, and also the ramifications of that, both in a positive and negative way, as you see it, Bob.
I think that it's certainly a dicey call, but I think that on both instances, the president made the right call. One of the problems we face here is that we could be very easily accused of gloating or dancing on the body of bin Laden. This would only help the remnants of Al-Qaeda fire up the energy to put together attacks to kill us. Well, by not showing the photo directly, we've done something to dampen that. But notice what we did show. We showed photos of bin Laden himself watching television of his own tapes. We showed personal photographs that only really bin Laden would likely have and that we got from – so this is really quite a good second best
picture. What about the celebration outside the White House? It looked like all the bars in Georgetown had emptied out.
It's one thing for the American public to celebrate. It's one thing for us on the radio to celebrate. It's another thing for the president or the government officially to celebrate. And I think that it may be the case that down the road in the coming weeks or months, there'll be another better reason to release the photo. But I think in the very short term, again, President Obama made a very smart choice.
Yeah. He showed respect for Islam, which also is important. There's also the whole context of institutional memory. He did not want to conjure up George Bush being on the aircraft carrier proclaiming victory.
Right.
There is a great controversy about the burial issue. If you read some of the informed Islamic scholars, they're not at all satisfied that this burial was in accordance with Islamic law for various reasons. So he didn't necessarily carry the day on that particular issue. But there's no reason for him to deliberately go out of his way to, one, inflame opinion, and secondly, create subsidiary issues. By not showing the photos, by going through with the burial, he, in a sense, eliminates another point of controversy.
Do you think the decision that he was going to be killed when the operation began, do you think that was known from the get-go?
That seems to be mixed. There's all these statements that it was a kill operation, yet what I find very odd is they appear to have given him a chance to surrender. They obviously wounded his wife intentionally. They were crack shots. On the other hand, bin Laden did not want to be taken alive. Something I wanted to pick up on, though, that I think is really important that Bob made, and that is showing those videos of him watching himself was about much more than proving they were there. That was part of demythologizing him, taking him down several pegs. Making him look like the sordid terrorist he was, not like this mastermind evil genius.
Was it somewhat pathetic?
They made him look pathetic.
A result,
yep, and that was, in fact, a brilliant piece of information operations. I think the White House handled it really well.
And just to build on this, also not just pathetic, but manipulative.
Yep, and narcissistic.
But manipulative in the sense that he, man with a white beard, a full white beard, shocking white beard, going to the extent of dyeing his beard. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say on the one side, well, this is just all superficial. No, in the age of communication to literally hundreds of millions of people, this amount of manipulation, that's the main message that came out. A man who would manipulate even his own image to get his way.
I want to go back.
Ahead.
Can I just go back to your question, Tom? I think this is a major issue about killing him. In Europe, this does not sit well. The European Court of Human Rights, when it comes to Northern Ireland, has found Britain to be in violation of the European Charter of Human Rights because they killed some Northern Ireland terrorists in Gibraltar. They view this very much as a criminal type of law enforcement issue. Mm-hmm. Obama has now really taken the path that this is war by the tactics and strategies that they have used. And the whole issue of, which we're not going to get into, of predator drones is a nightmare in terms of its legality. And let me just say, you cannot wish away the issue that they did go into Pakistan without their permission and invade a sovereign country and killed somebody. And the UN is investigating this. I don't think this issue is going to go away. And I do believe that they were intent on killing him. And a lot of the blog sites in the more liberal press are pointing out that this is a complete rejection of the Nuremberg principles and the rule of law.
But again, you would acknowledge that it is, notwithstanding what you just said, it is an immensely popular political decision.
It's the bin Laden exception. That's what they're calling it in the liberal.
But I would disagree with the Europeans on this one. And my argument is this. Is this man declared war in the United States with his fatwa in 1998. This was a purely military operation. We could have legally dropped 2,000-pound bombs on that compound and obliterated everybody. I don't believe that the Pakistani government was as ignorant of our general intentions as they've made out. For domestic political reasons, they misdistanced themselves. We didn't tell them when we were going to strike, but I'm not so sure they weren't a little more in the loop than they're pretending they were.
And also, it seems to me, which I think is going to be probably the cornerstone of his reelection campaign, unless, of course, he can talk about something positive with the economy. I mean, basically, he said this in the presidential primary debates, and he took a lot of flack for it. And Hillary Clinton said, well, why are you telegraphing what you're going to do? And when they played the clips the other night, he talked about actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. He was talking about Pakistan. He said, going in and getting bin Laden. You could not have been more specific. This was a dramatic campaign promise that he kept.
And not just a campaign promise, but a dramatic political risk. Going in, it looks like we had about an 80% probability that this was bin Laden. We did not have DNA confirmation. We, of course, had pictures, but about 80%. Had this gone belly up, had this been a failure, Bruce, this would have been worse than Jimmy Carter and the failure of Desert One. And what happened is that President Obama took a huge political risk to end the Al-Qaeda. And what he did was create the first major success in the war on terror. Not that it will necessarily end Al-Qaeda, but it creates an opportunity to follow it up in important ways where a year from now, a year and a half from now, we may actually be able to talk about the war on terror behind us.
How many people?
Can I link that up to what Tom said? I mean, Obama had the option of dropping the bomb, which he did not.
Yes.
And that makes the call even more gutsy. And also put it in the context of institutional memory, Jimmy Carter, Black Hawk down with Clinton. He risked his entire presidency, his entire legacy. And if you go look at, and the New York Times reported that President Bush pulled back from an opportunity to assassinate bin Laden or kill him. And if you go look at the 9/11 Commission report, there are four or five instances in which U.S. presidents did not pull the trigger on going after bin Laden, and Obama did it. And he's to be given full credit for that, but he took a huge risk.
Has he, in your view, has he put his own life on the line because of that decision?
I would argue. You're shaking
your head
now. No. How much more? Domestically, there's been a 242% increase in domestic militias since he was elected president. I think he's had a target circle on him since the day he raised his hand to take the oath of office. I don't think he's any more or less dangerous than at risk than he was the day before.
In fact, I think the bump that he's gotten in public opinion from this is temporary, because if you look at the polls, the popular support is coming from Tea Party and conservatives, because he already had the liberal base solidly in his corner. And will that support really persist over time?
It's going to be fought on the economic issues.
Right.
What signal does this send around the world? You said that it may not be that popular in certain sections of Europe, but I mean, what is the message about the gutsiness or the impropriety of going into a sovereign nation and pulling off a strike like this, allegedly without the awareness of the leaders?
Well, it actually sends one huge message, which is all this claim that Obama is a ditherer, essentially a wimp, not man enough to be president. This is just not true. And so the first thing that anybody now is going to see when they're dealing with the United States is that what they're dealing with is a president who is effective. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the first lesson for all around the world. Obama may not always win, but you're dealing with somebody who is now effective.
And also a strong character, which will be used in the election campaign as his signature. In addition, it shows that government's competent, which is a great change and a great transformation in terms of how people view it, and the U.S.'s ability to project a force abroad. And for the intelligence services, it's a resuscitation of this tarnished image that they've had for many, many years.
And this issue of sovereignty, I think we have to be very clear. When you're talking about a state like Pakistan, there are three centers of sovereignty here, at the very least: the ISI, the Internal Services Intelligence Directorate, the military, and the civilian government. Arguably, the civilian government is in many ways the weakest. So you're not talking about a unified sovereign state. And, you know, this is a principle that George Bush said, you know, that we are not going to respect boundaries if we feel somebody is harboring a terrorist. Now, we know that Pakistan has played a double game since the get-go. They've been a very ambivalent ally for perfectly understandable reasons. They don't know how long we're going to stay, and they got to live in this neighborhood. On the other hand, I don't really think that we can allow our security to be held hostage to that. This is an age in which the issue of international sovereignty is, I think, becoming murkier than it's ever been since 1648.
Nonetheless, you don't want people coming over here and kidnapping George
Absolutely
Bush.
Absolutely right. Well, sorry. Now, you raise a good point, Matt. I'm not
saying...
By the way,
let me just stop right now. I'm going to give you an opportunity to take that laugh back because we're going to be inundated with calls.
I know we are, yeah. I'll take the laugh back.
And your life may
Absolutely, and my life may be in danger. All I'm saying is I do have regard for sovereignty. I do have regard for national boundaries. On the other hand, I don't think that we can allow ourselves to be completely at the mercy of somebody hiding out in another state saying, you can't touch me because I am across an international line.
Okay, we have to pause. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our guests this evening include Robert Pate. He is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, also author of the book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, also a longtime advisor and also a teacher at the Air Force, with the U.S. Air Force,
yep.
And also taught at Dartmouth College for many, many years. Also with us this evening is Matthew Lipman. He is a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His area of expertise is human rights and genocide-related issues. And also this evening is Tom Kitis is here. He is a professor of history at DePaul University. Terrorism, counterterrorism are some of the areas that he focuses on. And he has written the biography of Osama bin Laden with a new last chapter just,
had to revise
just
it.
coming out of the word processor tonight, right?
A couple days ago, unless something else changes.
Comes back.
When did you, when did you begin writing the biography?
I think in about the middle or the beginning of 2009, and it was brought out in the spring of 2010, and I figured it was a done deal. But the publisher contacted me yesterday and said, how about a new cover blurb? And I said, well, the conclusion is only 5 pages. Can I rewrite it? Change some of the verbs to past tense, that sort of thing.
Yeah. What, with all that has been said and written about him for the last 10 years, what are some of the key points in that biography mm-hmm. that you think the average American does not know? New things that we don't know about him.
I think the thing that to me was so striking is how much this was a profoundly impressionable young man who was fought over by various power brokers. Abdullah Azzam, first of all, in the case of the Afghan war against the Soviets. Later, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian, and so on. And that, you know, he really was an individual who was very malleable. And then once he very much got himself into a role, he became incredibly good at creating his own mythology and cultivating it. He was such a minor player in the fight against the Soviets, but he built an image of this holy warrior willing to give up the life of luxury in Saudi Arabia and so on. And he really is a very much an image person and an icon, and I think that's how he's going to be remembered.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Given where he was living.
Yes.
Is this,
his image is tarnished.
Yeah. Is this notion that he was in the cave a bit of a mythology? Was that part of the public relations
presentation? Absolutely. It was that public relations manipulation goes back to the late 1980s when, you know, the real fighters, Hekmatyar and various others fighting the Soviets, didn't want these disaster tourists from Saudi Arabia. They wanted his money, his recruiting, and so on. But he was determined to fight. So he created this little band of Afghan Arabs, built himself a base camp, and he had to have that image of being in the cave. But he was never taken very seriously.
But he lived in a big house. But he didn't decorate it very well. It wasn't a mansion.
In some ways, you know, in some ways what I did find out, and it was also very interesting, is very little is known about him outside of Saudi Arabia. But he was Mohammed bin Laden, his father, raised his sons in a relatively austere manner. They were fairly conservative, and they had everything they could want. By the same tokens, he didn't pamper them either.
Is it
his biggest contribution?
His biggest contribution to Al-Qaeda?
generally, historically, when we
historically,
look back.
He's going to be remembered as the most prominent, influential terrorist in history to date because of his ability to energize and latch on to a lot of anger at an undifferentiated rage at the West and various other targets.
And Bob, made you one have you specific have a, contribution, which is it was Bin Laden who actually unified numerous local terrorist groups and argued to them, and he went to them one by one by one, to argue, you have your local problem in this area of the world, but behind it is the United States. The key that Bin Laden, what Bin Laden really brought was a unifying argument. And what Al-Qaeda actually is, many people argue, what is it? What is it? It's actually an alliance. Mm-hmm. It's an alliance of local groups who share one idea, which is behind their local problems is the United States. Mm-hmm. And it was Bin Laden who tried to, who pushed that more than anything else. And in fact, one of the big things that's happened just since January is that in instance after instance, Northern Africa, in Libya, and I believe in the future in Afghanistan, President Obama is unwinding many of Bin Laden's core arguments. And the group has actually, and that's why Bin Laden hasn't been speaking in the last few months, because his arguments don't look very good.
And the Arab Street is, we're hearing a different message from the Arab Street.
Well, here's
with
yeah.
what's happening.
Well, we
in
have
Tunisia
to get into some
Egypt.
Of the in some yeah. of the details. So, one of the key arguments that Bin Laden made against the United States and in Tunisia to get Tunisian terrorists to help him, in Egypt to get Egyptian terrorists to help him, in Morocco, in Northern Africa, was that the United States is backing authoritarian dictatorships to suppress democracy in Northern Africa. Now, most Americans will listen and say, what do you mean? We talk about democracy all the time. Well, but in Northern Africa, the fact is, until just the last few months, we have often backed authoritarian leaders against their populations, helping Bin Laden, probably inadvertently, of course. But what's happened for President Obama is he's reversed that. We're now helping the streets against many authoritarian leaders in Northern Africa, and that's just weakening the
energy.
Yeah,
I think, and it's also the young people who yeah. are his constituency who are rejecting his ideology. They're turning to democracy, which is anathema to Sharia law and to Bin Laden. And in addition, they are the U.S. is not, as you note, the impediment that he said it was, and you don't need to resort to violence.
Well, that's exactly right, Matt. And the reason Sharia was yeah. even in the game was because here's the great United States talking about promoting democracy, but then in certain countries in Northern Africa, not doing it. And that has fundamentally
there are
changed.
There are those that have been saying in the last week that this is the most significant U.S. military operation since D-Day. Overstated?
I would say it's profoundly overstated. I think it was brilliantly executed. I think it was an intelligence coup, but it was a very precise, short, sharp, surgical strike. I'm so tired of hearing we've cut off the head of the snake, because this isn't a snake. It's a starfish. It grows new arms.
Were you surprised that the president used those terms before the troops at Fort Campbell?
No, I'm not at all surprised, because that's part of the public relations and the spin. By the same tokens, this is a highly decentralized organization. I would add one thing to what Bob said, and that
so
is...
So are you saying it's not
no.
operationally, it's... This is not no. that significant an operation.
It is, but not for the reason people think. It was the information seized and the ability to put together a picture of what I would agree it is an alliance, but I would also say Al-Qaeda has become a brand name, a franchise. And the ability to put together a broader picture of this organization, its intentions, is far more important than killing Bin Laden himself.
Let's go to calls. Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on WKBN. Nice to hear from Ohio tonight.
Interesting program, Bruce. I have two major concerns. The first is I think we are receiving too much information for being in the middle of a war. You may recall it was reported about 6 or 7 years ago that we were intercepting cell phone calls from Bin Laden, so he stopped using his cell phone. It was reported that we were examining the landscape in the background behind him as he was giving his videos, and he put up a canvas behind him so that they couldn't get any clues. When you start telling how many hard drives we have and how we went in there and the clues we had as to where he was at, I think for being in the middle of war, that's a concern. The other concern I have is whenever we have this high technology, like the stealth helicopter or going back to the Bush administration, the first couple years of the W administration, the Chinese forced down a surveillance plane that had super technology on it. You know, we ought to do a better job of either protecting this multi-billion-dollar advanced technology or blowing it up. I mean, they could have lobbed a couple missiles at this helicopter to make sure that it was completely destroyed before the, you know, after they had pulled out.
Let's let Bob respond to that.
Your concerns are quite reasonable, but in many cases here, there's not much we can do about it, and getting ahead makes a lot of sense. So when we use something like the stealth helicopter and it crashes and we have to blow it up and we have to leave large pieces of it behind, once we've shown it, others are going to find out about it, and there's just not a lot we can do about it.
We've asked Pakistan to give it back to us. Well, we've also asked for the ability to interrogate Saddam's wife. I mean, are those, at this moment in time, let's talk about it politically and on an international stage, are those legitimate questions that we should ask, and how should Pakistan respond to those requests if they want an ongoing relationship with the United States?
They should. They're definitely legitimate to ask. But we remember, in 2001, in the early days of the Bush administration, there was an intelligence plane that the Chinese captured.
Yes.
The Chinese eventually did give it back to us in pieces after, we believe, they went over every single square millimeter of that. And that's not strange. We should, in fact, expect those kind of disclosures when we use highly sensitive. And I don't think that this is really, it is quite to be concerned. We should ask about it. We should follow up. But I don't really believe that what we're doing here is actually revealing the very best that we got.
I think once the photo was out, everybody's...
It's over. It's over.
But at this point,
they should give it back, though. I mean, is this a bargaining chit for more aid to Pakistan?
I think that they will give that up. It's a completely reasonable request after they've analyzed it. But this came up. This has been a point of contention as to whether the U.S. should have announced the amount of material that it obtained during the raid. Now, this would have been obvious to anybody who's a member of Al-Qaeda what the U.S. has. On the other hand, it is a completely valid point. And the argument is, well, they're scattering and therefore they're more vulnerable. But there is a completely valid point that there's much too much spin around this incident. There was precipitous race to the media in terms of factual information that absolutely is not true, and it makes the Obama administration look bad. The operation was obviously well planned and executed.
I want to talk more about it when we come back. Very good point. Back shortly.
He was smug. Well, he didn't think he had
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll bring you in on what we were talking about during the break and then take another call. I had asked the question is from a military operational standpoint, how this raid and the killing of Osama bin Laden, how that compared with the raid on Entebbe, which I think up until this point was viewed as one of the great military operations, certainly in recent times.
And although many of the specifics are different, Entebbe was a hostage crisis and so forth, politically they're going to be very, very similar. So they're going to go down in history as examples of small teams, highly trained, being able to pull off enormous successes with basically no real loss on our side.
Yeah. If that is true, then I can hear all kinds of people around the United States saying, why don't we just have more teams like this, fewer boots on the ground, fewer billions spent on predators, dropping bombs. Let's find 40 more. I think there were 40 people in this group.
Yep.
Let's find 40 more groups of 40, and that becomes our principal force to deal with the illnesses of the world.
It'd be really nice if it were that simple, but not everything is amenable to such a precision kind of operation, especially when I do a lot of work on counterinsurgency. If you're going in eliminating a leader, doing a decapitation strike, they're very good for that. Same as a hostage rescue, as was the case in Entebbe. If you're talking about stabilizing an area, it is still an incredibly labor-intensive operation with lots of boots on the ground. And that's why this is going to have no effect on the operation in Afghanistan.
What do you think?
Can we actually have more of a conversation?
Sure.
You can absolutely disagree.
Yeah, because it's
not so much
I disagree with some of the specific, slightly different context. The real question here is how we've had a one-day success. Morally and politically. The question is, will it be a success strategically? Now, there's a long history here of leadership decapitation. As we've talked offline, Jenna Jordan, who's a new PhD from the University of Chicago, has done a phenomenal four-year study of every instance to decapitate a leader of a terrorist group. And what she found is that, in fact, it rarely cripples the group. And often in the following months, it can actually incite them to do even more violence. The crucial, and that's why when the Israelis have assassinated leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas, they haven't put those groups out of business. They've, in fact, sometimes emboldened them.
Yeah.
But the crucial issue here is how can you take away the long-term support, often public support, for these large terrorist groups? You see, groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, and Al-Qaeda, these aren't 12 people. These are often hundreds and hundreds of people. They have significant popular support. And as you've heard me say on your show many times, for especially suicide terrorist groups, the core popular support comes from anger at the presence of large combat forces on territory that they prize. So if we do nothing to follow up the death with bin Laden by changing our foreign military policies, then in fact we're likely to just see Al-Qaeda reconstitute. But if we change our foreign military policies, continue the withdrawal from Iraq, which is going quite well, and begin major withdrawals from Afghanistan, say in 6 months, not immediately, but say 6 months, 12 months, I think we have a substantial chance of putting the war on terror behind us.
That's what I sincerely hope. That if there's one other positive thing about this that I would celebrate, and that is that this may provide the political cover to withdraw from Afghanistan without it making it look like we were giving up on something that is proving to be very, very difficult to accomplish. I like the idea more and more. Some of the people I work with do network mapping. In other words, they use something called the analyst notebook to take a look at terrorist networks the same way criminal organizations are. And they talk less and less about leaders and more about critical nodes. Think of bin Laden as, if you think of a power grid, he's a critical node. But there's redundancy in the grid, and he can be replaced. And I was on a program with Jenna. She has done a very good job, I would agree. And she said the same thing. You can in fact, they're going to shift to a different line. And what I think of is more and more, what we don't do is try to destroy, decapitate. We constrict its operating space. We contain it. We wear it down. It's more like fighting organized crime. You get it below a threshold of tolerance that you can live with.
One quick question, then we're going to talk more about it in the next hour. What did Pakistan know, and when did they know it?
Can I just make the point about Pakistan?
No.
I think their agenda is very different than the U.S., and I don't think that that's quite appreciated enough. They're concerned about two things, Kashmir and India, and solidifying control of Afghanistan, because Afghanistan, a destabilized Afghanistan, threatens Pakistan. We're concerned about the fact that they have nuclear weapons, but their interests are very different than ours. They're going to target those groups which they have historically that threaten them. They have very little interest in going after those groups that don't threaten the Pakistani state and further their interests in Afghanistan and are available to combat India and Kashmir. And
so if bin Laden is living 30 miles away, they don't really care.
Only to the extent that it threatens their relationship with the U.S. They have turned people over, but in my view, they turn them over periodically when they feel there's some threat in terms of the billions of dollars that we're pouring in there.
Or but they've had their chain pulled.
We have different power centers in Pakistan.
Plus the
seconds,
fact,
and then we gotta
Al-Qaeda,
go.
You know, Al-Qaeda is not as central to that strategic depth that they're concerned about as the Taliban is. They're more likely to protect the Taliban. Bin Laden was expendable. They weren't eager to give him up, but at the bottom line,
and
they could do without.
And this is why we probably had to rely on our own intelligence to get bin Laden. And it's probably not really coming via
Except he was had relations got, with Taliban.
Yeah, there was.
We've got to pause, gentlemen. We will continue in the next hour. For those of you who are watching this program on television, we hope that everything that we've just said is still current. and has not been dramatically changed by the events of the last 2 hours since we did the show live on radio. If you're watching us on radio, it's or listening to us on radio. Some people are just watching us on radio as well. But if you're listening to us on radio, this is real. It's live. Some of you might have just heard the president on 60 Minutes. You might want to call in and offer your assessment of that. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly for those Coast to Coast on radio. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of the book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Tom Akakis is here. He is a professor of history at DePaul University. And Matthew Lippman is a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We're talking, obviously, about the big story last week, the killing of Osama bin Laden, its impact on world politics, on Pakistani-U.S. relations, and most importantly, on the future of life as we know it in America. And I would like to begin, before we take a call, I'd like to get everyone's assessment about whether or not you think that we are any safer today than we were a week ago. Tom Mikaitis, you're shaking your head no.
You know, in the work I've done on terrorism, no, I don't think we are any. But we're no less, you know, less, more or less safe than we were. There will be a concerted effort on the part of al-Qaeda and its affiliates to demonstrate they have the capacity to hit us. But they will do that at the time and place of their own choosing. Expect heightened security at airports and so on in the next several months. But the fact is, you know, we have to go about our lives. I don't think we're at any greater risk than we were before. Although they would love to do something, they would have anyway.
Matthew Lippman.
I would like to think so, but I have to reluctantly conclude no. For one, the problems that breed terrorism still exist. Mm-hmm. And one of the centers of terrorist socialization is Europe, and that situation is not changed in mm-hmm. at all. And you still have a very young population, unemployment, all of the socioeconomic factors, and you still have American foreign policy, which is still going to be a flashpoint. So I have to say that we've eliminated bin Laden, but we have not eliminated the problem of terrorism.
Robert Pate?
I think the evidence shows that for a large terrorist group like al-Qaeda, in the very short term, in the next few weeks, actually there is a greater risk of attacks because the remnants of al-Qaeda are likely going to want to attack to show that they're still viable. But there's also an opportunity here that I don't think our intelligence folks are going to miss, which is what's happened is there's a wheel with a hub and spokes, and the death of bin Laden is taking out a hub. The spokes still remain, but for those spokes to actually be effective, I don't mean that they just kind of do an attack and go up in a blaze of glory, but to kill people, they're very likely going to have to talk to each other. They're going to have to plan. They may even have to do reconnaissance, and they're going to have to do it on the fly when they were surprised by events. That our intelligence folks knew what was coming, and therefore, as much as in the next week or two, or maybe even three or four, there's a greater risk, I believe there's also a chance for rolling up the group.
It's a spider web. It's not a hub and spoke. That's the problem. The other parts of the web are going to respond.
Anyway. You pointed out we went after al-Awlaki. We went after some people in Pakistan.
That's right.
Probably this intelligence we've scooped up had some relationship.
And I think
you said in the last hour, Professor, you suggested that maybe what's being spun here in the wake of the success of last week is that everybody's believing that we got this huge cache of treasure trove, if you will, of intelligence information. At least that's the story that's out there. Now, how do the scrambling leadership of al-Qaeda now, are we playing mind games with them? Are they thinking maybe we know more than we actually do? And does that make them desperate to do something, even if it doesn't succeed like an underwear bomb.
There's a good chance we are playing mind games. And what that does is it may scare current members of Al-Qaeda that they can't use their previously the means of communication that previously worked. So, for instance, we now know and have known for years that many Al-Qaeda groups like to communicate with draft email. So on your emails, you can write a draft, and you can save that draft, and then others can enter your email knowing your password to read the draft. Well, we not only know that concept, but we probably now are trying to scare members of Al-Qaeda that we know those code words. We know those passwords. What is that going to do? It may well scramble them to flush out and go to other areas, which in the next few weeks will be less secure. These are the kind of games that are involved with real covert operations. And that's why I say there's some possibility that as they're trying to talk to each other and as we scare them, we may actually be able to roll up pieces of the group that we wouldn't have been able to roll up before.
I think what my concern, though, is less the organization. There's another piece we're not considering, and that is there's a group called Dan Corm has done work on what are called random actors, people who are not affiliated at all but who are fellow travelers ideologically who will be infuriated that this man who is a kind of a Robin Hood figure for much of the street, at least in the Arab world, will be motivated, and they're not on anybody's radar. They're not part of any network or anything. And that's going to be a concern as well. So we are going through a window of increased vulnerability. Strategically, long term, that's going to even out, and I don't see any.
But those
huge
plans
change.
Probably aren't in place. But this is one thing that that Osama bin Laden was effective as an orator. He could inspire. We know that the Danish cartoon controversy and the attacks on the cartoonists really were a reflection of the statements that Osama bin Laden had issued. The Bali bombing, to some extent, was a reflection of his inspiration. So we do eliminate an iconic figure that is able to inspire people to act, and we eliminate a role model.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking just last night as I was watching Saturday Night Live, and I don't know how many people
saw it.
Literally in every skit, they went after Osama bin Laden.
Yep.
Virtually in every skit, certainly in the news. And I was thinking of the cartoonist. I was thinking about how thin, as an American, how thin-skinned many followers of Islam are with that issue. And there was a piece of me last night that worried about Saturday Night Live. That worried about the actors on that program because the ridicule that Osama bin Laden went through last night, not that he should be a sympathetic figure. I mean, he's a thug, he's a mass murderer. But I'm wondering if that might be viewed by one of these Lone Rangers that's out there.
That's the
South Park.
Yeah.
The creators of South Park received death threats when they had sent up Osama.
Are you worried? Does anybody share that concern?
Well, I think what it shows is you're going to have you have multiple audiences, and I think Seth Meyers. I remember the comment you said, Seth Meyers saying, "Look, White House, we're cool with you shooting him, no matter what, whether he was armed, unarmed, or holding a little bunny." But I think that misses a point that Matt has raised, which is important, is that the audience outside the U.S. is going to take that very differently, and I think you're right that is grist for the mill. Well, we'll show you. And I think, by the same tokens, in a free and democratic society, what are you supposed to do? They have the right to do that, and you really can't do anything about it.
I think that there's no doubt, like, say, in a football game, where when you try to show up the other team, there's a little bit of extra energy. But I think this is really quite small, Bruce. And the reason is because with a large suicide terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda, what they're doing is taking actions where they're willing to kill themselves on missions to kill us. This is just simply not a football game. It's not at that level. And yes, you're right. There's reason to be slightly concerned, but that's why we need to focus like a laser light on what really motivates suicide terrorists and what is the main urgency underneath it. But you're right, there's a tiny bit of issue here.
I want to talk about some of the information that has come out about what bin Laden was doing and thinking about and trying to organize some of the minorities in the United States and around the world. I want to talk about that when we come back. Obviously, a significant issue of a potential national security. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio, now channel 124. I'm Bruce Dumont.
I think Obama.
Two.
From Youngstown, Ohio to Tyler, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Al in Downers Grove, Illinois, listening to us on WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. I just wanted to say a couple points. One is that even though Pakistan has not been a perfect ally, they have really sacrificed more than any other ally. You know, they lost 5,000 troops and 30,000 of their people supporting us. And so, but even though they did that, I still supported the operation because this was a terrorist leader, a mass murderer. But I think we should only do this operation only for the terrorist leaders and not do drone attacks for, you know, every single possible terrorist. I mean, I think we should have some respect for national sovereignty. The second point, I just want to emphasize that these mass murderers aren't like, they're not like John Wayne Gacy, you know, psychopaths. They're doing this because of our foreign policy, which is resulting in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in their land and, you know, economic sanctions, occupations, you name it, you know. So I think we really got to reevaluate if we do unto others as we would like them to do unto us. And then I think they would do to us as we would like, you know, them to do. So okay. I think we need to have some common sense, foreign policy, some ethics. And then I think we do need to go and kill these terrorist leaders.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. Any comment on that, Bob?
Yes, I think that several of the points the caller made are right. Probably the biggest is that we need to reevaluate some key aspects of American foreign policy and military policy. And the caller, in the last hour, we talked about actually changing policy with ground forces. What the death of bin Laden shows is that we didn't need an army of 100,000 in Afghanistan to kill bin Laden. And in fact, it also shows that 100 drone attacks in western Pakistan for the last year really didn't get anywhere near bin Laden. The biggest thing that really mattered here was sort of meticulous intelligence gathering over time. That's the centerpiece of what occurred. Now, that's not to say that we should immediately end the army in Afghanistan or immediately end drone attacks, but I do think that it makes sense to reassess.
We're going to go to calls in just a moment, but Tom, last word to you, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, I would take the unpopular position of defending the drone attacks. If you compare the collateral damage from strategic bombing in the Second World War, I think part of what's happened is a profound shift in sensibilities towards what is acceptable. But in many ways, drone attacks are like sniping. They're nasty. They're ugly. People don't like them. Because they target people in this way. But on the other hand, you know, I think the leaders have some responsibility for hiding among human populations.
I just want to say we're probably collateral deaths are up to 30% of the individuals killed in these drone attacks are innocent civilians. It's done nothing but alienate the Pakistani people. I agree. It is a useful tool.
And just to build on what Matt said here, I'm not really making a moral point with respect to the drones. The Times Square bomber, he tried to set off a bomb and kill people in Times Square, and it's specifically about responding to the collateral deaths and drone attacks. In our database, and as you know, Bruce, we collect lots of detailed data on the suicide attackers in Afghanistan and elsewhere and by al-Qaeda. Those drone attacks are chapter and verse specifically motivating some of those suicide attacks to kill us.
Last week on this program, somebody made the comment about that when you look at how the political leaders wage war, Republicans like to send in boots on the ground, and Democrats like to bomb from 30,000 feet.
I think that's
they like to kill. They just don't want to. They don't want to.
Yep. And I know that kind
is
of
there a truth to that. Does everybody agree with that?
I think it's a bit of hyperbole. There may be an element of truth to it. I think where it comes out of, if you look at the Kosovo intervention, you know that there's a perception the American public will not tolerate casualties. I think what the American public will not tolerate is political leadership not making a compelling case for the necessity. And the problem is that these interventions have a shelf life. The longer they go, they're like milk. The more they sour. I think we've got the right strategy in Afghanistan, but we have it about 8 years too late.
Has this incident, in a political way, let's look at 2012 politics. Has this changed the image of the Democratic Party and
profoundly,
its leader.
If they capitalize on it, if they use this as an opportunity, as Bob said, to disengage from Afghanistan, to get this albatross off of our necks, then in fact, yes, I think they have changed it and shown that they are decisive. But that remains to be seen what will be done.
When you say pullback, are you saying without saying the words mission accomplished?
I don't know,
it's a combination.
I think it'll speak for itself. I think they could make a very strong case that we've accomplished one of our goals. We've done as much as we can do to bolster the regime in Kabul. And at some point, it's like throwing birds out of a nest to get them to fly. We've got to say, you know what? We hope you can fight off the Taliban, but we cannot stay here forever.
Obama has now established himself as a man of character, determination, and strength. He can get away with pulling the troops out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq, and not be viewed
as
soft.
And he can order a hit. And he can order a hit.
And, Bruce, it's already affecting the 2012 politics. Just in today's paper and yesterday's New York Times, there are stories that Republican donors are now pulling back. They're getting cautious. The Republican Party is already having problems as a result of the events in the last week. And why is that? One of the huge pillars the Republicans have used now, gosh, for almost 10 years, is that they're the party of national security. And what that's done is it's put money in the coffers of Republican candidates year and a half or so before an election.
Do they even have a candidate with any credibility on national security? I don't think
so. Not today.
Mm-mm. Not at the moment. Let's go to Mike Corpus Christi listening to us on XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening, your panel. Let me preface my statement by saying that I have some experience. I spent time in the Marine Corps as an active duty Marine from 75 through 79. And the last 35 years I spent in the enforcement of the civilian laws. And when you ask the question, do I feel any safer now that Osama bin Laden has been killed than I did before? Not necessarily. And the reason is because, obviously, my government is lying to me. They can't get their story straight. My boot print has been on the door handle of I can't tell you how many doors. Generally, we don't use a boot. We use what is called a ram, which is about a 50-pound instrument.
Okay.
But once I went in and once I was debriefed, and after every raid, no matter what the reason for the raid was, we were debriefed. And there was no doubt in my mind or anyone else's mind, I was number three in the stack. I was number one in the stack. What I did, I swept left or right, who I hit, who I didn't hit, what I saw.
Again, and your
it's
point
not
is,
that difficult.
Your point is what, sir? I'm missing your point.
These all of these stories coming out of what supposedly happened on the bin Laden raid,
yeah.
We're now up to what, 21, 25, 55? What all happened there? Who was where? Who had the hostage? Whether he had a weapon, whether he didn't have a weapon, I'm sorry, that's ridiculous.
Well, should we not know? I mean,
what does it matter?
Yeah, but Mike, I think you have a there's something underneath your point, but I don't think it's the government lying. I think it's helpful to remember that this is a covert operation and under tremendous pressure here by the world media and the public, you're getting details that are coming out. Now, many of those details may simply not be true. Why? It's because as reporters, under tremendous pressure to get details, they may simply be going to sources that are simply not themselves not very.
It was amazing today. Representatives of the administration said that it's not unusual to have our story wrong initially prior to debriefing.
True.
The question is, why did they come out and make these statements?
I would say that, to be fair to them, yeah,
because they were sorry, eager to take credit.
You're going to be asking me questions. You're going to be asking my partners questions. You want to know what happened from me.
Well,
here's my point, which I'm still trying to follow. Is it your position that the American people have a right to know operationally what happened in that raid?
No, but they also have a right not to be lied to.
I don't think
your story straight.
I think lying is harsh. I think they acted too precipitously. They wanted to, they did not think out how they were going to react to this event.
I just don't think it's true that the government's lying.
And they would be accused of not being transparent if they didn't say something. And I think the core facts of the mission have been remarkably consistent. Five dead, Osama's dead, no U.S. casualties. And where there was ambiguity, it was corrected. Thank you, by the way, for serving the country, but I don't agree that your government has lied to you.
What would you be thinking if you were Muammar Gaddafi tonight?
I would be thinking that you don't, that we have a long memory and real determination, and this guy in the White House that I thought was a light touch is a little more serious than I imagined.
I would beef up his security a little bit.
I don't think he can beef it up anymore. I think he's really thinking is I missed an opportunity a month ago to cut a deal.
Cut a deal and get out of here.
Cindy in Boardman, Ohio on WKBN in beautiful Columbiana County, Ohio. Go ahead.
Good evening. About four quick points. One thing I find ironic are, terrorism is worldwide, and after 9/11, everybody wanted to get to know their neighbor more and everything, and nobody seemed to know who was living in that compound. You know, like when the ball would come over, they'd give rabbits instead of giving their ball back or money or something. But anyway, for someone who had so much money and so much power, I heard there was mold on the walls. And why didn't the government go talk to his other wives and children to get some information before now?
Well, they probably have done that. And again, I think being a lousy housekeeper is just one of the bad things about Osama bin Laden.
It's not unusual. I can tell you from having been in about 45 or 6 countries that it's not at all unusual for people to live in these enclosures where you focus on your extended family, your client networks. You don't worry that much about what's next door.
It's like living in Bel Air, California. 1-800-723-8289. Nobody knows what goes on behind those walls.
Let's be fair. It was a military installation.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Robert Pape is here. He is professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He is also the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And tell us a little bit before I introduce the rest of the guests, and I'm going to ask everybody, your passion for this subject. Again, you have chronicled every suicide bombing attack
in the last 30 years, since 1980, when the modern phenomenon began, over 2,200 attacks. Mm-hmm. If listeners will go to our website, Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, it's CPOST, they'll find a database of 2,200 suicide attacks, not verifiable, but verified, with multiple sources, the actual text put online for each and every attack, so that you can actually track suicide attacks all around the world over the last 30 years.
And also, your publication, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic, also, you did Bombing to Win, which was about air power.
That's right.
And you've, as I've said, you have been
and
an
I just
advisor
published
to the
a
Air
few,
Force.
And just published a few months ago, Cutting the Fuse, the explosion of global suicide terrorism and how to stop it, which is, again, a continuation of the work on suicide
terrorism. How did your interest in national security and international security, where did that stem from?
It came from when I was an undergrad at the University of Pittsburgh, I wanted to go into the Foreign Service. And so going into the Foreign Service, I thought I should learn a fair bit about national security affairs. And one of the things I wanted to do was get a PhD. So at the University of Chicago, I came and I started to study how we lost the Vietnam War, because I wanted to know. So when I went into the Foreign Service, I'd have some understanding of the biggest failure we've had. And of course, that was about air power, because we had tremendous air power advantages, and I wanted to know, how could we possibly lose? Well, what I did is I studied every air campaign in history, eventually 40 air campaigns in the 20th century, to really try to understand what are both the opportunities for air power and the limits.
Also with us this evening, Matthew Lippman. He is a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And Matthew, let me ask you the same question. You're interested in criminology and, again, genocide and torture and human rights. What's the origin of that passion?
Since we're all professors, I want to credit the fact that I was inspired by great teachers that had a view that the world is an important place to know about, to study, to travel and be involved in. And this is something, we're talking about terrorism, that we need to emphasize that we need to be much more literate in terms of our appreciation of global affairs. And I credit my colleagues for being in the forefront of that effort.
That's great.
Isn't one of the key lessons that maybe many in America don't quite at least think about often is that we are singular in thinking about we want all of the leaders of the world, certainly those that we believe are our friends, we want them always to act in the best interest of the United States. And in frequent situations, and I think the country and the leadership of Pakistan is example number one, sometimes you just cannot do that and survive. You can't stay alive, you can't be reelected, and you just can't do it. And we don't, we're not as sophisticated as perhaps we should be in understanding that.
I think we've made that point about Pakistan, that they're really more concerned about India, about Kashmir, about a stable Afghanistan. We're concerned about the fact they have nuclear weapons. Their agenda, their interest, in some extent, conflicts with ours, and we need to understand that and find a place where we both can find a common ground. But in my lifetime, Professor Pape has referenced Southeast Asia. We were dragged in there. We knew nothing about it. We've been involved in the Balkans that Tom's been heavily involved in. We knew nothing about it. Now we're in the Middle East. We know nothing about it. And we're really acting out of a weakness in terms of our intellectual understanding of the situations we're getting involved in, which I think is really one of the – is at the root of the problems that we're confronting today. And we don't understand bin Laden or the whole phenomenon of terrorism or the new uprising of for democracy in the Middle East.
Tom Akaitis also joins us. He is a professor of history at DePaul University. And what specific areas of history are you – do you focus on? And again, what was the interest that sparked you as a young – student?
I'm in an interesting position. I'm a historian for whom historical events have sort of overran my scholarship. I was interested in military history, fascinated by Britain and the Empire, and classically trained as a British-Irish national historian. And I wrote my dissertation and first book on the British Army's handling of unrest at the end of the Empire, insurgency, which involved terrorism. And then in the 90s, I was at a turning point in my career where I could have continued following the receding wave of declassification of British documents and just stayed in that trough of history. But I got more interested in saying how the past could inform the conduct of operations in the present. So my first two books were on British coin. Third one was on how that model was useful in doing peace operations in the Balkans, Somalia, and various places in the 90s. And then, of course, you know, terrorism being a huge part of it. Another part of my passion is trying to take and communicate to a non-academic audience this kind of work that we do. And my last two books for Prager Security have focused on that, as has the bin Laden biography, to kind of demythologize this scary field.
Let's go to Mark, KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Got a question?
Yeah, I do, actually. I'm interested because I've followed this with great interest for the last 7 years, this whole idea and, frankly, in my mind, myth of bin Laden, how it is possible. I'd like to know the gentleman who wrote the book, the biography of bin Laden, what your research points were, and how many of those involved Pakistani intelligence, Israeli intelligence, MI6, British intelligence, and indeed the CIA intelligence apparatus, who many of whom, prominent members of whom, including Madeleine Albright, came out and had said years ago that bin Laden died from a horrific disease. I'm not going to get off into be branded a tin hat wearing conspiracy theorist, because that seems to be the common refrain when people try to ask critical questions of issues that seem to be used, given the fact that the consensus seems to be now we're less safe since this myth is gone, and the security apparatus indeed should tighten around the American people's neck.
Now, let's let Tom respond to your question.
Yeah. First of all, what I used were open sources. I do not have a security clearance. Stephen Coley's book, if you want a more detailed treatment, the Bin Laden's and Arabian Family in the American Century. Scheuer has a retired CIA agent. There's a couple others I'm aware of as well. But I can assure you bin Laden was real. He did not die. He was not on dialysis and so on. When I talk about his mythical qualities, I'm talking about the way in which he elevated his importance and marketed himself. But I see no evidence that he was killed earlier or anything like that.
Joe in Waukegan, Illinois, on WLS. You're on the air.
Yeah, if I were an Arab in the street and they were trying to recruit me, I'd be looking at the last 10 years and think, okay, we had a high point on September 11th, but then after that, it's mostly been about killing Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you're, you know, Osama has had his high mark, but what's he done lately?
Well, of course, he had the successes in Madrid, Spain in 2004, London in 2005. You know, just as we've said, better to kill them over there than to fight them over here. They've said, well, you came to Iraq and we were able to kill 4,000 or 5,000 of you. We're doing similar things in Afghanistan. I think they could make a pretty compelling case.
The ratio is like...
Joe, and I think the biggest problem... I think the biggest problem with your point, which I certainly take as a reasonable point, is that so then on September 10th, 2001, you would say the threat was zero.
Well, no, but what I'd say
Well, I mean, but think about what I'm just trying to show you the logic. You're saying that you want to measure the threat by the date of the last major attack to kill thousands of Americans. And by the way, this is a you're not being unreasonable, but I do think it's a wrong way to measure the threat.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay, then I'll go ahead.
What I am saying is, as things stand today, the kill ratio, one Westerner for every 15 Muslims in the Middle East, that's not a good ratio. I mean, that's a losing ratio. If anything, you know, you're going to wipe out, if you're Osama bin Laden and you're going to push this thing to the end, you're going to wipe out all Muslims in the world everywhere long before you kill off even half the United States.
There's no doubt that you're right that, in fact, by al-Qaeda killing civilians, they've been running headlong into a wind of protests actually in the Muslim world. Doesn't tend to get reflected so much here in the American press, I think for pretty obvious reasons, but it is definitely the case that there, and I can even tell you about certain groups of former terrorists that have written documents criticizing al-Qaeda specifically on this point. But let me just, but your first point about what has Osama done lately, notice how that is a very tempting way to measure the threat, and it would simply be wrongheaded. The better way to measure the threat is simply by the ongoing efforts that al-Qaeda has been making to kill us and simply to recruit, which I'm afraid has been continuing, even though, thank goodness, they haven't been as successful as September 11th.
It still looks to me like al-Qaeda is a bigger threat to Islamic, to Muslims than the West ever was,
Then that should mean that as we withdraw our armies from Afghanistan and complete it from Iraq, we should be able to actually mobilize Muslims to actually go out after al-Qaeda and finish the job.
Matthew, did you want to add something?
I think we've seen evidence of homegrown terrorism in this country.
Oh,
it's
sure.
been quite a significant threat. The New York subways, Times Square, Fort Hood. So I don't think that we can minimize the threat that these types of movements pose to us. Also, and I'm sure other people like to weigh in on this, this is not a rational decision whether to be involved with al-Qaeda. This is an ideological decision, a religious decision, a nationalist decision.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we're going to talk about an attempt in 1999 to kill Osama bin Laden, and also about al-Qaeda efforts to mobilize the minorities of the United States.
We haven't talked about Bush yet. Is there snobbishness?
From Greenville, South Carolina to Rockmart, Georgia, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. One of the, again, pieces of information that has come out over the last week is al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's exploration of how to fan the flames and ingratiate himself with the minorities, viewing the minorities of America as an element that might be able to be stirred up and turned against the country.
Yes, and Bin Laden is not the first person to think of this. In 20, 25 years ago, Gaddafi himself actually at various points thought in similar ways. The difference is that we should worry that Bin Laden would have been more successful. Because as I said in the last hour, one of Bin Laden's most important contributions was sort of as a CEO, being able to build strategic alliances among subunits. In his specific case, it was working with local groups, terrorist groups, if you would, that had grievances motivating them to argue they should become part of an alliance, a unify their efforts to go after the common enemy.
But Gaddafi put his money where his mouth was.
Well, he did, but he also did it in ways that were obviously, we found out about it. The FBI was able to track this. I don't think Gaddafi really got very far. The worry with Bin Laden is he might have been able to be more successful.
Yeah, the group that has had some real tangible success with this is Al-Shabaab operating out of Somalia. Radicalizing young men in the Twin Cities, the Somali communities. Now, there's been an NGO created in Britain that has got some traction at countering that kind of ideology. The Brits have done some very good work on this. But often immigrant, young immigrant males in particular, first generation, suffer from what's called double alienation. They don't identify with their parents' root culture. They want to be young Americans, but they're not particularly welcomed in. And as a result, they're in this kind of no man's land, and they're easily recruited. That's the story of the London bombers. There's a great book called The Islamist by Ed Hussein, which talks about this radicalization process in Britain. It's a superb read on how that is done.
But this is also a terrorist tactic, division amongst the population. This is why President Bush and Obama have been very concerned about not making this a war on Islam. You don't want to create an alienated group within your population that poses a potential threat.
I mentioned before the break that in March of 1999, President Bill Clinton was in the White House.
Yep.
And there was an attempt to get
there was a failed attempt to get Bin Laden that I think helps put some of today's events into context. And I know the story from Michael Scheuer. Michael Scheuer was the top CIA person running the Al-Qaeda shop at the time. And he's written numerous books. And the key story is that in March 1999, we had overhead intelligence that Bin Laden was on a safari, on a hunt, essentially, in the UAE. And he went hunting and was staying at a small camp outside of the main base camp, but we had an operative in the main base camp. The main operative told us that Bin Laden was staying in a small enough camp, we couldn't find it on overhead, but that he was coming for dinner routinely night after night at certain hours. He gave us that information, and we put together a small team of people to go and get him. And as this went forward, Sandy Berger, our national security advisor, thought it best to inform the UAE before we actually launched. Well, what happened is the next time our overhead went over, the entire base camp completely disappeared. We lost all track of Bin Laden because of that early warning to the UAE, at least as Michael Scheuer believed.
Don't we also have the story with the cruise missile attack on Obama's camp?
That was 6 months before. That
Pakistanis were told.
That was 6 months before. And so the key problem here is informing the host country has been problematic.
Gentlemen, we have some really good questions coming in. I'm going to ask for them. Nicholas in El Paso, Texas, KTSM, you've got a great question. Give it to us quickly so we can respond to it quickly. Go ahead.
Yes, yes, Bruce, excellent program. Yes, I think we could have gone in there and done a snatch of Bin Laden. We could have brought him out, waterboarded him, take him to a secret location, kept him here. We could have done more damage to Al-Qaeda, and nobody would have known who was living there. Nobody know except
Al-Qaeda. Let's let everybody respond to that. Had this been a quiet kidnapping, would that not have been a better idea?
No, I think it would have been a huge mistake because, as I said, I don't think we would have gotten that much information from him that we didn't scoop up in the raid. And, in fact, we would have lost a lot of credibility.
Eric Holder said, no way Bin Laden's ever taken alive.
Yeah, Bin Laden didn't want to be taken alive. And he didn't want to be taken
alive. Dave in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, WAPI. I hope people are getting their lives back together there. It's going to take a long time, but our prayers are with you. But you have a good question tonight. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. And we're not the only one that's had disasters like that. I'd like to, first of all, say that we deeply appreciate President Obama coming to visit. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, it does not matter. He is your president. He's my president. He's our president. And it meant a lot, especially considering the fact that he had all this weighing on his mind when he visited. Also, it seems to me that no matter if you're president, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And also, I would just like to say, I used to fly into Newark, New Jersey all the time, or quite often.
15 seconds.
Okay, I used to see the trade towers. There were Jews, Christians, Muslims, women, children, whatever. Let's don't forget that this man that orchestrated this thing did not care. And I think President Obama did a courageous thing and the way it was handled. That's all I have to say about it.
Good final word. I totally agree with you. Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Tom Mikakis, professor of history at DePaul University. Matthew Lippman, professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois, Chicago, have all joined us tonight. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Vera Cruz and Lauren Goldman and Mark Glick for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, happy Mother's Day, everybody. This is Bruce Dumont. So long from Chicago.